This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. Once again, this fall and spring, we expect here on the program to be talking with a number of people who come here to the university to give talks. And one series of talks that we have now followed for many years is something called the MillerCom series, sponsored in large part by the folks at the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus. The first talk this fall in the series takes place tonight, and the topic is the politics of Mexico. Our guest for this hour of the program is Larissa Lumnitz. She is a researcher emeritus of sociocultural anthropology in the Department of Applied Mathematics and Systems at Mexico's National University. It is the most important university in Mexico and the biggest in Latin America. And she's here to talk a little bit about the symbolism behind political campaigns, concentrating on particularly on one campaign in the past. But I was hoping that she might say a couple of things, share some of her thoughts, as someone who's at least been watching as a citizen what has been going on in Mexico recently, talk a little bit about the last presidential contest that we had. Voters in Mexico went to the polls in July to elect a new president. The winner appeared at that time to be Felipe Calderon, although it was very close. The top electoral court yesterday finally gave their final decision, saying that indeed Mr. Calderon would be the next president. However, his margin of victory was extremely slim. And ever since the election, the man who came in number two, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he and his supporters continued to protest the outcome, and they continued to do that, saying that he would accept nothing less than being named president of Mexico. We will perhaps talk a little bit, try to talk a little bit about current politics, but also about the past, and talk a little bit maybe about how those things are connected, how the present and the past are connected, as we talk this morning with our guest. And, of course, questions are welcome. People who are listening are welcome to call, and I know that our guest would do her best to respond. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
I appreciate it. I know that you would not claim to be an expert on necessarily on contemporary Mexican politics, but I'm interested in trying to talk a little bit about this election. And I guess one of the things that interests me is when you look at the result here, we had more than something like 41.5 million people voted. And the top two finishers, Mr. Calderon and Mr. López Obrador, were separated by not many over 233,000 votes. I mean, it was just that it was really, really close. And one could imagine it going either way for either of the candidates. So here we have two men who have very different agendas. They seem to draw their support from very different constituencies. They come from different places on the political spectrum in Mexico. What does it say about Mexico that it could have been this close between these two candidates?
Mm-hmm. Well, for that, maybe I can tell a little bit about the history of elections in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, the 20th century was ruled by the PRI, the Partido Revolucionario Institucional, since 1920, more or less, until the year 2000. Now, for years after the revolution, a system was created, but elections really didn't have, I mean, formally, Mexico was a perfect democracy. It was like an American democracy with a strong president, division of powers, check and balances, elections, regular elections, parties, although, of course, the dominant party was the PRI, but there were other smaller parties that were kept alive in order to be a formal democracy. Mm-hmm. Now, since the year 2000, when the PRI lost for the first time the electoral campaign, the presidency, a lot of reforms even before, the last two pre-presidents made a lot of reforms in order to give Mexico the status of a democracy, because the only thing that didn't, the only thing for which he did it, it didn't qualify as a democracy, was the fact that there was no change of parties in power. In other words, if you went to a political sociology or whatever department in the States, and you saw the list of countries that were not democratic, Mexico was among them. And if you ask them, but listen, we have a constitution that shows that we are just as democratic as the United States, the answer would be yes, but there hasn't been no change in power. So anyway, but by the year maybe 1990, there were several reforms which made it almost impossible to fill up in a illegal way the urns and so on and so forth. So I think that then the Instituto Electoral made, as I said, a lot of reforms, and it was practically impossible now to do fraud. So, but anyway, that is the difference between an old pre-election, and the present-day elections. So what was the aim of having a big campaign? They had enormous campaigns. One of them I studied, moving people back and forth, north to south, etc., 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 if there was really no, if it was not important to see who won, because everybody knew who would win. And it was, I claim that there are formal and informal rules, and the formal rules were very democratic, etc., but informal rules really meaning patronage systems, the monopoly of the PRI on bringing people and having them vote and controlling perfectly well the elections, didn't make the PRI legitimate. So these campaigns in which a lot of people were going to the plazas and seeing what we see now López Obrador doing, it had as a main purpose legitimation of something that was legally in quotation marks, correct, but not legitimate. Now, López Obrador used to be a member of the PRI. Then he shifted to the PRD, which is a party in which many old PRI members belonged, as a matter of fact. It's still ruled by ex-PRI members, including López Obrador. And so they knew all the tricks, so to speak. But I believe there was no fraud at all. Mm-hmm. But it was a very close election. But there has been a lot of close elections later, lately, in Costa Rica, in Germany. I don't remember which one, but there are two or three elections that have been very, very close, like this one, which doesn't mean that there was any fraud. Mm.
Well, and as you say, for a very long time, the dominant party was the PRI, mm-hmm. and that the president in Mexico serves a 6-year term. You can only serve one term. So I'm sure what would happen is near the end of the time, when it was time for the next election, all of the guys in the PRI would all get together, and the cabinet ministers and everybody, and someone would be picked to be the candidate for the next time, right, knowing that that meant that guy would be the next president.
Exactly.
Everybody knew whoever the candidate of the PRI was, the PRI would make sure that mm-hmm. fellow was elected. And that happened over and over again until we started to see some weakening of the power of the PRI. And then, as you say, in 2000, that was when Mr. Fox, Vicente Fox, who was the party of a candidate of the National Action Party, the PAN, the same party from which Felipe Calderon comes. Mm-hmm. He was the energy minister. That was the first presidential winner not to come from the PRI in, I don't know, since the 20s or something like that, right? More or less. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, since the PRI was founded.
Yeah, since, yeah, all the time that they were founded, they had control of government. So that was a big change that was very mm-hmm. significant. It sounds that as if, and you explained that, you know, that the PRI would continue during the time that they were down, and they would sort of go through all the motions. There would be rallies, and they wanted to do everything they could to make it look like it was a real race, when in fact everybody knew it mm-hmm. wasn't. It sounds as if, though, now that in addition to the fact that this election was extremely close, it sounds as if perhaps there are people in Mexico that still don't trust the idea that an election could be fair, mm-hmm. that the idea of the people in power stacking the deck, whether that's now the PAN or was the PRI, it sounds as if there are a lot of people who just don't believe that you could have a fair mm-hmm. election in Mexico.
Well, yes, that is true. But there is a lot of people that want to modernize. I think now the real struggle was between a group of citizens, a slight majority, but still a majority, mm-hmm. of people that want Mexico to enter the 21st century and modernize and enter into the global system, et cetera, et cetera. And a more traditional group of like the deep Mexico, you know, of people that follow certain culture. And that culture is based on clientelism, not one man, one vote, but on the fact that there are certain leaders, which is an old tradition, caciques, caudillos, leaders that control vertical groups, vertical networks, and eventually are also loyal to the big leader. Mm-hmm. And López Obrador seems to me as a character of a caudillo, you know, of a old-fashioned leader that produces emotions in a very populistic way. Of course, personally, you can see that I am in favor of modernization. And a lot of people are not. In fact, a lot of my university colleagues are very much in favor of change and all that, no? Mm. But I think seeing the matter in a cooler way, I mean, it's either going to the 21st century or coming back to the beginning of the 20th century.
One of the things that I wonder about, having read the stories about the protests that have been going on now of the election result, those that have been carried on by Mr. López Obrador and his supporters, I find myself wondering just how much control he himself has over this, or whether this is something that's gotten away from him a little bit, and it has something also to do with all of those people who are at the levels below him interested also in their power bases mm-hmm. as well. So that it's about people arguing for the power of the PRD as much as it is people maybe saying that López Obrador should be the next president.
Well, I think it's both. And now the crucial thing is what is going to happen now. And I think López Obrador is not giving up. He definitely wants to be president. But legally, of course, he cannot. Of course, he can continue protesting for the next 6 years, or he can become active in his own party, perhaps become the president of the party, and maintain this effervescence for 6 years and run for president next time. But he doesn't seem to have the patience to do that. He mm-hmm. definitely wants to be the president. So The big question now is whether the party will follow him. Because, you see, he has claimed that everything is a fraud, but at the same time, his party won the second place in Congress, and the congressmen and senators already took their possession of their positions. And the head of Mexico City, which is practically a republic of its own, is also PRD. So what will they do? Will they actually accept the election as legal, since they already won, Or will they continue thinking that there was a fraud, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Now, the party won like never before. I mean, a left-wing party to have a second force and be so close is quite an achievement. So it will really depend on what will the party do. If the party is going to continue supporting him like they did in the last 1st of September when President Fox had to give a speech and he couldn't enter the party Congress. And so that was his party moving in and doing that. And as they say, they still fight inside the Congress and they fight outside the Congress. So either that or the party is going to kind of slowly move away from him. This is what we don't know. On the other hand, there is another type of worry, which is we have the Day of Independence is May 15th, and usually the president goes to the balcony and rings a bell, you know, Mexicanos, Viva México, Viva México, etc. No? And the following day, May 16th, the army has a big parade with tanks and planes and the whole parade. No? And all the streets where the army has to march are taken by this protest campings. And so what will the army do? Will they march on top of them? Will they put themselves to a side and let them walk? Or will there be any violence? Mm-hmm. And this is personally what worries me, that there should be some victims, some violence, revolutionary violence or military violence. And then, of course, the party will be over.
Yeah, and that's on the 16th
of September.
Of September. So it just so not that it's 10 days away.
And then, of course, there is the day when the new president has to take over, and they also can make it impossible for him to walk into Congress.
Yeah, that's December 1st.
December 1st.
Yeah. That's you put your finger on what the very question that I had was, and I would be certain that there would be people who would make the very argument that you did to Mr. Lopez Obrador and his party. They would say, look, no one from your side of the political spectrum has ever done this well. You're the second leading party in the Congress and the parliament. This is a very good position from you to work from. Why not say, okay, we came in second, but we have a lot of influence here, and we go on. You know, that it would seem to me that would make more sense than continuing to say we don't accept the result of the election. But as you say, I guess it just remains to be seen whether pragmatism prevail or not.
Mm. Yes, all of us are worried. I mean, I had no doubt that the tribunal was going to give the victory to Calderon because he won by little, but he won.
Yeah.
And in democracy, supposedly by one vote, you can win.
Back in the day when the PRI was dominant, you I know in the talk that you're going to give, you want to talk particularly about the election of Carlos Salinas.
Mm-hmm.
And which was maybe the last election in which the PRI was as strong as it was. It was after that point that things started to sort of come apart, maybe for the PRI. And people started to say the day was coming when maybe the PRI, in fact, would lose. Given that people realized that it was kind of a sham in the sense that we were pretending we were having an election, but everybody knew who the next president would be. It would be the candidate of the PRI. Why anybody actually played? I mean, why did people play along? They could at least have just said, well, I'm just going to stay home. I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to go to the rally. This is silly because it's not a real democracy. So why are we pretending that it is? Why did people just go along with that?
Well, the PRI was a labor party. It controlled the different confederations of workers, the peasants, industrial workers and public employees. And so it really had control of a big mass of people. And they also, I mean, after all, the PRI took over a country that was in shambles after the revolution in 1917. and President Calles remade the republic and organized the country through a big bureaucracy in the three sectors. It was really always a labor party, center and center left. And they also organized the big educational system, the big health system. Mexico became really quite a country within the 20th century under the PRI. Actually, what happened was that Salinas was the first president that, in a way, moved the country towards a neoliberal, globalized policy, you know, with the trade, North American trade, you know. ¿Cómo se dice?
Oh, NAFTA.
NAFTA, mm-hmm. Exactly. Thank you. And and that made that big difference and split within the party, in other words. And that's when the PRD was born under Cárdenas, who was the son of the big, important Cárdenas. And Cárdenas started the party precisely during the when Salinas was nominated the candidate of the PRI. In other words, the PRI always had that tradition of keeping inside it several streams, left, center, or right, you know. But every time a candidate was elected, the other ones, the PRI candidates, kept quiet until their turn would come maybe next time. In other words, they had internally, they had their elections every 6 years also. But there was a kind of loyalty pact in which whoever lost would keep quiet, except a few cases in history where they did what López Obrador is doing. Mm-hmm. So most people kept going doing it because precisely because of the traditional form of doing politics, basically clientelism, clientelistic leaders that controlled whole groups, whole unions, whole states, etc. Well, if they won, they also would give towards their people this redistribution of goods.
So it was in
the interest of everybody.
Here, I think the word we would use is patronage.
It was an enormous patronage. Patronage is the other side of clientelism. A patron has his clients.
I was trying to search my memory. This was the election in which Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas ran against Salinas, and wasn't that the case that pretty much everybody thought actually that Cárdenas won?
Yes,
and that because they had
the famous fall of the system.
The system crashed, and Mr. Cárdenas was ahead, and suddenly the system crashed, and when it came back up again, they say, "Oh, look, exactly. Mr. Salinas won. How about
and
that?"
And that was the basis of the claim that vote by vote, urn by urn, because they also brought back the 1988 campaign election day, but it was a different situation. Yes, nobody knows whether Cárdenas won, but at least Salinas didn't win by much.
Yeah. Where is Mr. Salinas now? Is he still outside of the country? Nobody knows where he is?
Well,
or they're not sure.
He lives in Ireland, but he comes very often to Mexico.
Oh, really? Well, let us talk with a couple of folks here. Maybe again I should also introduce again our guest, Larissa Lomnitz. She is researcher emeritus of sociocultural anthropology at Mexico's National University. And she's here to talk a little bit about culture and politics in Mexico and look at the symbolism behind political campaigns, particularly concentrating on this one that we just sort of touched on, which was the election of Carlos Salinas. And she will be giving a talk tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. This is a talk in the MillerCom series, and anyone who is interested in attending should feel free. It's free and open to the public. And here questions are welcome, too. We have a couple of people who'd like to get in on the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Callers will help us by being brief so that we can accommodate as many as possible. We'll start here by talking with somebody in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Yes?
Yes.
The I think one of the reasons why people are not accepting the vote is because of the election your scholar has written about. And one can say the computer crash, but it's pretty clear that the election would have been PRD, and NAFTA would have been different if it would have happened at all, and we wouldn't have corn dumped on the Mexican countryside, and we wouldn't have as many desperate immigrants as we have from Mexico right now. It thinks, you know, there's this history here, I think, is being slighted. I heard something in the way you spoke about development and modernization. You contrast it with the people that want change. Well, modernization can be change, and modernization doesn't have to be simply neoliberalism. There can be other models. And I'm rather disappointed to hear this offhanded dismissal of the critiques. There was a supposed leak from the Electoral Commission, which showed that the votes that were reassigned in the 10% countage actually the overwhelming majority of them went to Obrador, and very few went the other way. So count by count, vote by vote, probably would or could arguably have it a difference. I'll ask you to respond. Thanks.
All right. Well, can you respond?
Hello?
Yeah, we're here. Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. I think you are absolutely right in doubting everything, but there is no proof of that. And everybody in Mexico agreed that the tribunal had the last word, and that's what they decided. How can you tell for sure that there was fraud if the tribunal didn't? Do you have any idea why you say that?
Well, the caller left us. I put him back on hold, and he hung up. It was my understanding that, well, at least the stories that I have read, said that the tribunal did order a partial recount of some of the votes. Mm-hmm. And based on that result, the tribunal said that even if we did a full recount, it would not change the outcome. And that, as Mr. Lopez Obrador has continued to say, he would like to have a complete recount, although mm-hmm. he also has been quoted as saying that he wouldn't accept any result other than him being the winner. Mm-hmm. Do you think that some people have questions about this partial recount and what it found?
No. I don't know who. López Obrador is not accepting anything except being the president. So the rest of us just have to believe the tribunal.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk with another caller here, someone in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. We happen to have been in Mexico City in mid-July. I don't speak Spanish, unfortunately. But it was at the time of the run-up to a big demonstration in the main square in Mexico City. And as I was walking around, the day before, I walked up to the Alameda, and I was really impressed at the political signs that were up. It wasn't anything like I would have seen here in the U.S., and I was impressed enough to take a bunch of photographs of them. They were a mixture of text, and some had cartoons, some had interesting artwork, all of which had the point that of pushing people, promoting the idea that there had been fraud, don't give up hope, the media is making idiots of us, this sort of thing. And they were printed professionally. I would say they were about 4 feet high by 8 feet wide. They were printed professionally on a sort of vinyl-covered cloth that you might have for making professional banners, and they were mounted on PVC pipe frames that were resting in concrete bases. So they weren't just handmade signs that you might see for a protest, say, here in the U.S. And there were names printed on the bottom of each, two names, maybe one for the text and maybe one for the artwork. I'm not sure. a lot of money had to have gone into those, and I was not only impressed by the way that the professionalism, but I was wondering where that money had come from. Being ignorant, pretty ignorant about all this going on, but knowing that it was happening, I was surprised at the money that had gone into this. So when I asked, we had hired a driver and car to take us out to see some things in a suburb, and so we asked him what his opinion of this was, and he said, "Well, oh, they've paid everybody to come, and they're providing them with lunches." So his impression, this was somebody whose work was being interrupted, who felt as though everybody coming to the march was just coming because they were being offered free food and a ride and a day out. Other people didn't feel that way. A young man that I spoke to, I asked him to translate one of the banners for me, asked what the U.S. thought about this, if the U.S. was going to do anything about this fraud. And I didn't want to tell him that probably a lot of people in the U.S. really weren't paying any attention. But what I said to him was, we can't exactly, given our recent history, stand up as knights in shining armor and claim that we have any way of, that we can talk about somebody else's possible election fraud. It was an interesting experience, one that was done with a lot of ignorance, but still interesting impressions. Any comments?
Well, yes. The Electoral Institute, the one that organizes elections, gives each candidate a big amount of money so that they can conduct their campaigns and do propaganda, etc. So the PRD also received that money, and they probably used it, in fact, to make those posters, etc., etc. There was a rumor that people that went to that not only to the parade, but the ones that occupied Reforma and the Zócalo, there were rumors that they received a salary to be present day and night there. But of course, I cannot really say if that is true. But anyway, all parties receive a big amount of money to conduct their campaigns.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Well, do then are parties limited to that? Can then they go out and raise private money? Can they accept contributions? Or is it supposed to only be the public funding?
Supposedly only the public money, okay. But they do. Right-wing, even Fox, after his election, they found out that they had this huge money coming from the Amigos, the Frog, the Fox, and organizations like that. And they probably also have some. Also, the Mexico City is ruled by the PRD, and it's a big city with a lot of money. No? Mm-hmm. So, but let's say that it was everything legal in that sense.
Okay.
They have money to do that.
We want to get, I think we do have our first caller back, and I think that he did want to continue to engage you about the, I'm sorry.
I'm inadvertently, not your fault, yeah. It's my phone system here. I try to roam around the yard a little too much, I guess. In my question to you, or my statement, I mentioned that there was a leak from the Electoral Commission that showed in the 10% or so count that many votes had been transferred to Obrador, and very few had been collected in favor of the former oil minister, who is apparently going to privatize Pemex, among other things. But in addition to that, of course, the Electoral Commission did report that Fox inappropriately tried to influence the election by his statements he made throughout. He's not supposed to do that. They have a different system, The present president is supposed to be quiet on the election. He didn't. Walmart and a number of other American corporations paid for ads, and this was also mentioned by the commission. But they claim that it didn't. They could calculate that it didn't sway enough votes. So it seems to me there are a lot of reasons, and the fact that the election you've written about is widely hailed as being a stolen election. The PRI did this in a variety of ways, so there's a lot of reason to be suspicious of this result too. I think rather than me having to prove that it was faulty, it was, I think you should feel incumbent upon you, if you're defending the decision, to prove that it was okay. And the Electoral Commission, in its own report, stated things that probably were enough to annul the election.
You mean this one?
This one.
Or the...
The other one, too, but obviously...
Well, but I am not... I am not writing about this election at all. I just, from the very beginning, said I have studied a past election, and I am commenting as a citizen, but not as a scholar, this one.
I'm the one who's put the guest in this position because I really wanted to talk about this current election, and that's not what she's going to be talking about in her talk. I hope the caller will forgive me because I got a couple of other people here that I want to try to get onto. It just seems to me though that the big challenge here is for the future is going to be getting people to believe that whatever the outcome of an election is, getting people to believe that that's honest, that there has not been any fraud one way or another. When the past has been the way it has been, it seems to me that it's likely going to take some time before people start to actually have some faith in the outcome of elections.
Right, probably so. But anyway, we have to go on with legality. And by the way, incidentally, my study was about the campaign, the ritual of the campaign, the symbolism and rituals of Mexican culture, political culture. I didn't go in to study the electoral day and the votes and so on that specialists did, and I am not mixing and interfering in that. So if you excuse me, I will only talk about what I know, not about I don't know. I know that you are sure that there was a fraud, but a lot of people are sure that it was impossible to have fraud. It's a typical populistic trick to say five times the same thing and finally they become a proven truth. But unless you can prove it that there was a fraud, I wouldn't particularly go on claiming that.
Well, let's talk with some other people. Let's go to Champagne next, and this is Line 1. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I want to make a comment about it. I just was in Mexico a couple weeks ago, and in the last 2 months I was there a few times for family problems. And I see the situation very hard, very tough, just in my family. They are going for three different parties. You know, in my family in Mexico, my son was president of one of the, how you call it, like where the people vote, one of those
places. Casillas. Mm-hmm.
Yes, he was there, and he's young. He's just here. His majority, and not too long ago, and he was selected for a president on one of these places. And he told me he was very disappointed because he was there in the counting and everything, and in the end, they say something different what the results were. They say the people who were there with him, and he didn't say nothing because he's just starting a family and he doesn't want to get involved in problems. But he told me, "Mom, it's very bad. I'm seeing that it's so much corruption." He say, "I don't know what's happening in the other places, but in mine, the election, the results are not the ones we got, are different." So he was very disappointed, and I believe it's probably very people thinks now that it changed so fast. Just this past election, this past president, I mean, the actual president, is so many things against him, like the other people said, even advertising to pro his party when he's supposed to be doing it. And I have a friend who belongs to this party on the power right now. She's very powerful. She's a business person. And I know for a fact, because I was there, that she was giving money to people in the government to get construction work, because she's an architect. I mean, for me it was a big shock, because that's what we were accusing the PRI in the past to doing it. And they were doing it right now with a new party, just like in older times, if no worse. So I really believe, it's very hard to believe. I'm not sure if the actual president win or not. I know many people said López Obrador is dangerous because he's a leader. He's charismatic, and sometimes that people is dangerous for the country because it's not easy to, maybe he wants to stay longer. The Constitution is very clear that anybody will stay just 6 years in the power, no more. I'm not sure about them. I don't know them. I am in the United States for 10 years now, so I really don't know how good or bad they are, but I know that it's very difficult to trust in the results. That's all my comment.
Well, I thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Anything that you want to say about that?
No, thank you very much.
All right, we'll go to line two. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hi. As someone who was a young man in Mexico in 1965 and also in the 70s, I have to say I'm very impressed. I know perhaps the electoral system is not as perfect as it could be in Mexico, and I don't think those of us in the United States really understand that Mexico is a very young country and that the revolution kind of is always present in people's minds. So people objecting to the election is no real surprise given the history. But I think given the changes and the structural changes in Mexico, it's rather amazing that there's even a discussion of this and that people are allowed to protest. I don't think that's something that would have happened in the 60s and 70s, and I think it's wonderful that the army is staying out of it or is at least doing it behind the scenes. So I just want to say this is a tremendous progress for Mexico, and that's my comment. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the comment. Again, you want to...
No, thank you so much for your comment.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit less, in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Larissa Lomnitz. She's a researcher emeritus of sociocultural anthropology at Mexico's National University. And she is a sociologist by
anthropologist.
Anthropologist by training, not a political scientist, and is here to give a talk in the MillerCom series talking about the symbolism behind political campaigns in Mexico, particularly this one that we have talked about, in which the candidate of at that time the ruling party, the PRI, was Carlos Salinas, and of course he was elected. Can you talk just a little bit now? I feel I should apologize. We really haven't talked about your area very much. Whether you could talk a little bit about symbolism in political campaigns and the way in which at that time the PRI would have used that. Would there be certain kinds of things that they would have done in the way that they presented themselves that would have been things that everybody in Mexico would recognize? They would know what those things mean.
Well, as I said, I did this ethnographic study of the campaign, and it was a huge campaign where people were driving north and south, etc. And it had a format. It was theatrical, and there were a lot of... there was a kind of hidden language, informal hidden language, symbolic language, which sent messages to all the participants. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily a journalistic language. For instance, the basic unit of that system of rituals was the state election, states. I mean, we are also a federal nation, and there are 29 or 20, 32 states. I forget. And the candidate and his entourage would go to every one of the states and spend three, four, 5 days going and visiting different communities, workers, peasants, rotaries, businessmen, women, young people, etc., etc. And in each one, the candidate would dress up accordingly and give certain speeches and talk about certain things. And they were talking to particular groups. For instance, in every state where there was an important Indian community, indigenous community, there are 58 different ethnic groups, communities. Well, for instance, in one was the Maya group, which was done in one of the Maya sites, and the way he would dress, the way the public would dress, the way the speeches and everything had all kind of symbolic meanings. For instance, in this sense, there was a symbol reversal by which the Indians were treated. They were supposed to be the founders of the nation, of the country, and they were given a special place. For instance, when we went to this Maya site, the candidate said, well, when I accepted this invitation to talk here in Uxmal, I asked for it not to be a rally, but to be a kind of ritual, because we all came from here, etc., 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 you know, and then children came with the pigeons, and a witch doctor, Maya witch doctor, made all these ablutions for the four winds, etc., etc. And then, of course, a leader came in with a contract to be signed by the candidate. The contract was done in Amate, in this, you know, these pictures that they are done by tree barks, you know, the old way to write codices. And they had like 13 points. One of them was to fight for Uxmal being a universal site by UNESCO. The other one was to have bilingual education. The third one was to maintain the price of corn. In other words, they went back and forth in different levels of abstraction. But the main thing is that Yucatan has a big Maya population, and so the Indians were given its place. And then we moved on and we went to a women's rally, and the women's rally usually was done in fancy hotels where women of all kinds, Indian workers, peasants, upper class intellectuals, etc., were dressed in their best attires. And the candidate, of course, came very well dressed with a tie and with a coat. While when he went to talk to the workers, he wore a leather jacket and a hard top hat, and in the way they talked, etc., etc., you know, they were conveying all kinds things, saying, you know, this is your position in society, this is our history, etc., etc. You live in a happy country ruled by happy.
So whoever they were talking to, they were the most important people in the world, obviously.
Yes, of
course. Same thing, and I'm sure that American politics.
Yes, well, politics is the same. I mean, everywhere. I mean, there is a kind of underlying language which is represented by symbols.
And that, I don't expect that is something that is likely to change particularly. I'm sure in the last presidential contest, the same candidates probably did the same sorts of things. They would travel to the same places. They talked to the same groups. Whoever they were talking to, the idea was they were trying to say to that people, I'm with you. I'm one of you. You're the bedrock of Mexican society. And whatever your issues are, those are my issues, too.
Yes, I just want to read a little paragraph of my conclusions. Mm-hmm. That in the campaign, the candidate used specific Mexican rituals to reaffirm the fundamental pacts between president, party, and society, and to negotiate the positions which different groups and people would have in the next term. He also used the campaign, the candidate, to project himself as the next great patron of the political pyramid.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, if you are interested in hearing some more from our guest and you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and the campus, I'm sure there will be more. She will have more to say on this very subject in the talk that she's giving tonight, Culture and Politics in Mexico, the Symbolism Behind Political Campaigns. And that's a part of the MillerCom series tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on the campus on West Illinois in Urbana. This is the first one for this fall, and all of these events, they're always free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop in. Our guest, Larissa Lomnitz from the National University of Mexico. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.